Hello, this is David Murphy. Today is June 3rd, 2026. I will be reading from The Nation. I begin with The Dismantling of Black Studies by Jafari Sinclair Allen. Everyone I know in the U.S. Academy, students, staff, faculty, university publishers, and cultural institution workers is afraid. But the recent assault on higher education is not evenly distributed. Black studies is where the attack has been most deliberate, the most structural, and the most revealing of what is at stake. In recent months, university leaders have dismantled departments and deliberately narrowed the pipeline, producing the next generation of black scholars. What is happening is not just a series of isolated bureaucratic decisions. It is a coordinated assault. The overall chilling effect on academia of these moves and what they reveal about the erosion of democracy and freedom of thought in the United States can be enervating. But I have turned to an admonition from André Lourdes in a poem that was itself an act of self-preservation. It is better to speak, remembering we were never meant to survive. For students and scholars of black studies across the country, the process of collective speaking began in earnest on March 5th when Columbia University's Institute for Research in African American Studies, which I lead, hosted a virtual event titled What We Stand to Lose, a national forum on black studies under fire. I counted 780 people in the webinar at the height of the discussion. The cases presented were specific and damning. The University of Texas at Austin had folded its renowned Department of African and American Diaspora Studies into a generic social and cultural analysis studies unit. Florida's Senate Bill 266 had stripped black study courses of their general education status and cut the research funding that faculty depend on. Kentucky's House Bill 4 had suspended the University of Louisville's Pan-African Studies doctoral program and eliminated all graduate assistantships. What emerged from that evening was not despair, but a shared and pointed a diagnosis that these were not isolated local crises, but nodes in a coordinated sequence. First rhetorical, then legal, then administrative, and the field's most urgent challenge is not only the government's relentless crackdown on higher education, but also the preemptive measures that institutions are taking to comply with anticipated attacks. Given its scale, this assault is not ours alone to fight. Everyone committed to democracy, intellectual freedom, and the rule of law should be alarmed at what is happening and be prepared to act. The attacks on black studies are not only connected to the tectonic rightward shifts we are all experiencing in every terrain of modern life in the United States, but fundamental to them. It is at the nexus of a project funded by a network of conservative foundations that aims to reverse generations of hard-won progress. The government has waged this war on behalf of those interests to restore an order in which certain kinds of knowledge, certain kinds of people, and certain kinds of life are returned to the margins, where, in this worldview, they belong. What is happening is the product of a sequence that is familiar to students of American history. Following the rapid progress that took place during the Reconstruction era, the Supreme Court systematically dismantled the legal architecture of black citizenship, and the country settled back into an arrangement that white citizens apparently found more comfortable. This reneging on the promise of Reconstruction happened in a short period after the Civil War amendments had been ratified, after black men had served in Congress and held office across the South, and after the Freedmen's Bureau had built more than 1,000 schools in a decade. Everything that had been won was reversed, not in spite of the law, but through it. We're watching that sequence again. What is being unmade this time is not only the right to vote or the right to citizenship, both of which are being whittled away, but also the right to know, the right to make knowledge, and the right to tell the truth. Black studies is not merely a container for scholarship. It is the set of practices and habits of mind development over long intellectual tradition that began before black people were permitted to attend any educational institution in the United States. Learning to read was itself an act of resistance, routinely punished with violence and sometimes death. South Carolina's Negro Act of 1740, or an act for the better ordering and governing of Negroes and other slaves in this province, made it a criminal offense to teach enslaved people to write, among the other ways it refined the enslaved people as chattel. Every state in the Deep South followed suit. These new laws targeted writing because writing is the technology of legal personhood, contracts, passes, manumission papers, and official testimony. The logic was clear. Writing is a tool with which to make claims of personhood and belonging. The long black intellectual tradition did not wait for institutional permission. It built itself in churches and newspapers, in art, music, and literature, and in the margins of Qurans and Bibles, and in the holds of ships. When it finally won its way into the academy, it built itself again. While the standard account of how black studies came to exist in the American university is accurate and should not be minimalized, strikes at San Francisco State in 1968 and a campus takeover at Cornell in 1969, campus shutdowns and occupations that spread across the country, that account does not always acknowledge what happened after students' demands were partially met or how those demands were channeled into particular institutional forms or who underwrote those forms. As Noe Rooks argues in White Money, Black Power, the philanthropic funding of black studies did not simply help expand the field, it shaped it in specific ways. Grants from the Ford Foundation during the field's early years favored supplementing the existing curricula at predominantly white institutions over the autonomous, self-governing departments that black student activists had demanded, producing a field that has been dependent on administrative goodwill from its inception. The American Studies scholar Roderick Ferguson extends this analysis. the university's incorporation of black studies was an exercise of power, calibrated to absorb the field's critical force, precisely by appearing to welcome it. Black studies, strengthened by the diversity within the field, has revised, expanded, and corrected history, and transformed academic disciplines and the terms of popular debate. It has provided generations of students of every radical and ethic background with the tools to participate productively in a multiracial democracy. This success is precisely why it is under attack. But there is a second reason. Inseparable from the first, at the very moment black studies became impossible to ignore, its opponents decided they could no longer tolerate it. Visibility and vulnerability arrived together. My colleague, Farah Jasmine Griffin, captured what this moment of blacklash revealed. Movements are long in the making, she wrote. Activists, organizers, artists, and thinkers invest time, do the work, preparing, imagining new possibilities, and identifying the way. Finally, an ember ignited by a myriad of factors takes flame and becomes incandescent. This is precisely what Black Studies has been for more than 50 years. The long preparation, the imagining of new possibilities, the identifying of the way. After George Floyd was murdered by police on May 25, 2020, and protests erupted in all 50 states and more than 60 countries, that preparation became visible on a scale its opponents could not ignore. In June 2020, all of the top 10 nonfiction titles on the New York Times bestseller list were by black authors or about race, a milestone in the world of publishing. The prevalence of PhDs and faculty members on the bestseller list was a unique feature of the era. Strands of the long black intellectual tradition became visible, legible, and highly marketable in unprecedented numbers. Even as the backlash was being organized, the same summer saw a record-breaking surge in the sales of anti-racist books and protests for systematic reforms also saw a rapid legislative and judicial reaction. The incandescence that cleared ground for transformation became another sort of beacon for those who feared transformation, a call to arms. Christopher Rufo's campaign to pervert and weaponize the term critical race theory, a campaign triggered by the College Board's proposed Advanced Placement African American Studies curriculum, bore direct legislative fruit. By 2022, more than 40 states had introduced bills restricting the teaching of diversive concepts, a phrase lifted from the vocabulary of the first Trump administration. Texas's House Bill 3979, Kentucky's House Bill 4, and Florida's Stop Woke Act and Senate Bill 266 were among the most sweeping. The laws were immediately contested in federal court. Andrea Quigley, one of the scholars who spoke at the March 5th Black Studies Forum, is a plaintiff in the ongoing federal lawsuit against Florida's SB 266. But the legislation did not halt their effect, especially after the hard right secured a series of crucial wins. and the culmination of a generations-long legal battle, in June 2023, the Supreme Court struck down race-conscious admissions in Students for Fair Admissions v. Harvard. The logic that had long treated black studies as a demographic concession, a diversity mechanism, and a recruitment tool, rather than as a scholarly discipline within its own intellectual authority and reason for being, now had a legal warrant. This conflation with affirmation, action, and DEI made black studies acutely vulnerable to whatever fate might befall affirmative action itself. Simply put, the terms of entry contain the terms of eviction. After Trump's second inauguration, his administration wasted no time in launching probes into institutions of higher education. His executive orders targeting diversity initiatives bear Orwellian titles like Ending Illegal Discrimination and Restoring Merit-Based Opportunity, which invoke the language of civil rights to dismantle civil rights infrastructure and directed civil rights divisions to investigate and penalize the very programs designed to make civil rights law meaningful. In March 2025, the Department of Education opened civil rights investigations against 45 universities for their participation in the PhD Project, a 32-year-old nonprofit that has helped more than 1,700 black, indigenous, and Latino students earn doctoral degrees. One-third of those universities, including Yale, Duke, MIT, Ohio State, and Michigan, have since signed agreements cutting ties with the organization. Education Secretary Linda Mahon called this the Trump effect in action. I understand the situation not only from my vantage as the director of Columbia's Institute for Research in African American Studies and a professor of African American and African Diaspora Studies, but also as a student. In the late 1990s, I returned to college after a long stint away. I was a work-study student in the Africana Studies program at New York University, which comprised a beautiful suite of offices, a seminar room, and a library filled with African art. Writers, musicians, artists, filmmakers, and actors regularly dropped by for what felt like an ongoing extracurricular graduate seminar. Across the hall was the Asian Pacific American Studies program, which had its own resources and intellectual agenda. The connections that formed, scholars thinking together about diaspora, colonialism, and belonging, were possible because each program could show up as itself. We were intellectual neighbors, not because an administrator had decided that all the subalterns should be housed together to feed at the same shallow resource trough, but because each formation had been built into something that could stand on its own. In 2005, NYU quietly folded its African Studies program into a broader administrative umbrella called the Department of Social and Cultural Analysis, without meaningful consultation with the faculty and students who would be affected. One day, there was a program and an intellectually rich and generative space. The next day, there was an announcement and a reorganization. At the time, this move was called prudent. we should have paid more attention. Dissolving into social and cultural analysis, what took 50 years to build was a ruthless redistribution, a wrestling away of earned power. What remains a distinct scholarly project is being subjected to a process whose outcome has not merely already been determined, but has been decided off campus in what I can only imagine are dank, smoke-filled bunkers at the Heritage Foundation and the Manhattan Institute, which co-authored the model anti-DEI legislation that Texas enacted and then praised the Texas campaign, calling on the federal government to defund universities that do not comply. Their work is financed by the same groups that have spent decades building the legal and legislative infrastructure now being deployed against the public universities. On February 12, 2026, the news arrived that the way bad news often does now. Colleagues pinging one another across time zones about the latest development in what had become a litany of academic catastrophes that had been mounting since Students for Fair Admissions v. Harvard, but which took on head-spinning velocity with Trump's second inauguration and crackdowns by universities on students protesting in solidarity with Gaza. The leaders of the Black Studies programs at UT Austin learned in a 30-minute Zoom call that the department would be folded, along with American Studies, Mexican-American Studies, and Latino Studies and Women's Gender and Sexuality Studies, into yet another Department of Social and Cultural Analysis, the blandly efficient label that's shaping up to be the preferred nomenclature. More than 800 students are currently enrolled in the department being dismantled. 1 week after UT Austin announced the consolidation, the university's governor-appointed regents voted unanimously to limit what they called unnecessary controversial subjects in the curriculum. This purposefully vague language is part and parcel of the moves by the Trump administration to censor Smithsonian Museum exhibits and limit the guilt white people might feel when confronting U.S. history, for example. Undefined controversy as an administrative criterion is a mandate to be afraid, and the mandate is being issued everywhere at once. On February 20th, NYU canceled 13 cultural, identity, and faith-based graduation celebrations, including for Black, Latin, LGBTQ+, and first-generation students, citing the current political climate, without elaboration. NYU is not a public university in a red state. It is a private research university in Manhattan's Greenwich Village. The false dichotomy of red state, blue state, public, private, flagship, Ivy, has become not only debilitating, but dangerous. The assault on the academy does not recognize those distinctions. Neither should our resistance. I keep returning to an image that Healthier Maggie gives us in her book, The Sum of Us, What Racism Costs Everyone and How We Can Prosper Together. The city of Montgomery, Alabama, in 1959, filling its public swimming pools with cement rather than allow Black children to swim in them. And it wasn't just the pools, the parks, the zoo, the community center. All public spaces were shuttered for more than a decade. McGee documents this pattern throughout American public life. The willingness to destroy the commons rather than share them. Pools around the country were not drained because they were expensive or dangerous or posed any harm. They were drained because white citizens found black presence in those pools intolerable. And as white children sweltered in the heat, believing that something had been taken from them that was rightfully theirs, their parents continued to insist that the pools had been closed for everyone's benefit. Black Studies is the pool. All over the country, you can hear cement trucks rumbling down the streets. The political theorist Juliet Hooker gives us an analytical frame this moment requires. The black grief / white grievance, Hooker argues that American democracy is structured by a fundamental asymmetry. Black citizens are expected to absorb political loss without breathing a word of grief, while white citizens are permitted to experience and bemoan losses that have not yet occurred, and in many cases never will, as legitimate political wounds demanding remedies. What the current moment calls a restoration, a return to some undivided and uncontested American knowledge before things became unnecessarily controversial, is a grievance projected from a past that never existed. Those were the days, sang Archie and Edith Bunker. Make America great again, to chant the president and his supporters. The regents of UT Austin solemnly voting to protect students from subjects they cannot name are singing the same song. The harm they insist be remedied cannot be documented because it has not occurred. This is anticipatory grievance, laundered through the administrative process and dressed in the false attire of stewardship and public trust. And yet, the performance of that imaginary loss produces entirely real consequences for actual people. Vice President J.D. Vance, who holds degrees from Ohio State and Yale, has called educators enemies. He and other Ivy League educated men and women in the administration who are tracking academic freedom do not want to destroy the university because it is elite. They want to remake all universities in their own old image and with all the old exclusions. Their quarrel is not with the so-called elite universities, and it is certainly not with real elites. They are mad at what their alma maters look like when black students and scholars are fully present in them, when the pool, in other words, is open. The knee-jerk accusation of elitism is key scene-setting shtick in the political theater, performed to force those who object to the destruction to disqualify themselves before speaking, so that the work of destruction may continue without witness. I joined Columbia's Department of African American and African Diaspora Studies, which grew out of the Institute for Research in African American Studies, in 2023, founded by Manning Marable, who was one of the most widely read and influential scholars of the late 20th century. The department also publishes Souls, a critical journal of black politics, culture, and society, which Marable launched in 1999. As its editor, I often sit in his chair, not metaphorically, but literally. I am telling you this not to establish a credential, but to offer an orientation. I know what it feels like to inherit hard-won infrastructure, and to feel, in the same moment, how fragile that infrastructure is. Columbia has been specifically targeted by the current administration. Federal funds frozen, governance restructured under duress. The institution, and by definition, all universities, was never and should not be the uncomplicated sanctuary that some, from the outside, thought it to be. Marable understood this. He spent decades insisting that the intellectual life of black people deserved a permanent institutional home at one of the world's great universities. Adjacent to Harlem, in the city of New York, he knew that black studies was neither a gift that any university bestowed on black people, nor a cosmetic service to an institution. It was a demand that black people made that their lives and their thought be treated as the center of inquiry rather than the margin of someone else's program. Marable and many others worked so that the next generation would inherit infrastructure rather than rubble. I feel the weight of that inheritance precisely because what was built is not permanent. Right now, in the United States, it is being tested in ways that he anticipated and that we are still learning to meet. Across this country, university leaders and trustees, seduced by the path of least resistance that the words social and cultural analysis seem to promise, must recognize that diminishing or dissolving departments in black, gender, queer, and ethnic studies, canceling graduation ceremonies, and placing academic programs under federal conditions are not educational judgments or even smart budgetary decisions. These are choices to participate in a political project whose trajectory is already historically clear, a project whose other nodes include book bans, voting restrictions, and the suppression of immigrant and LGBTQ rights, leading to the diminishment of everyone's rights and making rule of law, academic freedom, and citizenship meaningless rhetoric left for the dustbin of history. The signal they send that belonging is conditional and subject to revision whenever the political climate makes it inconvenient will outlast this administration. It will be remembered, even if these short-sighted decisions destroy the university and fill it with cement. This country has been here before, and more than once, sweltering in the heat of the disappearance of a common good and blaming the wrong folks. The question is not whether we understand the arc of this history. The question is whether we will bend it or silently watch it break. Nobody Heard Me at Amazon by Bryce Covert. About 3 years ago, Keisha's Hollis's boyfriend, now her fiancé, helped her get a job as a boxer at Amazon, which paid $23 an hour. The new job enabled her to move out of the motel where she'd been living with her sister and her sister's family. Hollis worked 12-hour overnight shifts, packaging and moving heavy boxes filled with the sundry items that Amazon customers regularly order. It was a financial lifesaver for Hollis, and all was going well, until she got pregnant. On a shift one night, she strained to lift a heavy box and started bleeding. She went to the emergency room, where medical providers advised her not to lift heavy objects for 10 days to protect her pregnancy. When she returned to work with a doctor's note to that effect, she was fired. The termination meant that she couldn't reapply to work at Amazon for 3 months. During that time, she moved into her mother's 3-bedroom house, where she lived with 5 other people. With no income to provide for baby's needs, she decided to get an abortion. "I didn't have that baby because finances weren't permitting," she said. When the 3-month period ended, Hollis got another job at a smaller Amazon warehouse. When she again got pregnant in the summer of 2024, she was worried. "I didn't want to lose my job like I did the last time," she said. But she reasoned that she could do things the proper way by telling the company up front and asking for accommodations to avoid health problems while working. Unbeknownst to her, in the time between her 2 stints at Amazon, a new law, the Pregnant Workers Fairness Act, went into effect. The PWFA should have protected her on the job, but that's not what happened. When Hollis informed Amazon about her pregnancy, she was told to get her doctor to fill out paperwork so that she could get on-the-job accommodations. But her doctor told her that, because it was so early in the pregnancy, she could continue to work normally. Hollis figured that she could tough out the fatigue for a while longer, but Amazon didn't agree. When she informed the company of her doctor's recommendation, which would have required no immediate changes to her job, she was placed on unpaid leave. While she was on leave, her doctor sent over paperwork outlining the accommodations Hollis would need when she returned. She wasn't supposed to climb ladders or lift, push, or pull anything 30 pounds or heavier. She should also be given extra rest and bathroom breaks as needed. After her unpaid leave was up, Hollis asked her supervisor if she could return to work and was told that she was being put on another unpaid leave while the company considered her request for accommodations. "I'm sitting at home for weeks. No pay in my pocket, no way to feed myself," she said. "It was very emotionally stressful. It was physically stressful. It was just stressful all the way around." Finally, Hollis was told that her accommodations had been approved and that she could return to work. But when she got there, it was immediately clear that nothing had changed. Her entire job entailed climbing up and down a sliding ladder to stow items on a top shelf, she said. She was denied extra breaks, even just 15 minutes to sit or grab a snack. She strained herself pushing a box that was heavier than her daughter's recommendation limit. She also learned that the involuntary leaves of absence was eaten into her bank of unpaid leave time off. Amazon gives each new hire a bank of hours and deducts from it every time the employee misses work, threatening termination if the total goes too far into negative territory. Workers say that the company approves absences very infrequently, even when they are sick or need to attend a doctor's appointment. When Hollis called Amazon's Human Resources Department to find out why she was still assigned risk tasks other than her doctor had said she needed to avoid, she was told she would have to work it out with the employees at that particular warehouse. But the HR team at the warehouse told her that her accommodations had been set up correctly. She felt like they were ping-ponging her back and forth, she told me. Finally, she decided to take the bus to the warehouse on a day off to sort it out once and for all. Sobbing all the way there, Hollis spoke with a warehouse supervisor who pulled up her original request and said that it had been entered incorrectly. It couldn't be fixed, she was told. Instead, she had to start the process all over again, asking her doctor to resend the paperwork and go on another unpaid leave. It was the week of her 25th birthday, but she couldn't afford a celebration, not even a cake. Amazon had ripped that out of my pockets, she said. A week later, Hollis returned to work, again with negative unpaid time off. After she clocked in, her manager said she couldn't find the accommodations in the system and couldn't allow her to work the shift she'd been assigned to, given her restrictions. HR told her that she had to be sent home because there were no jobs she could work. Once again, she was put on unpaid leave. Hollis kept calling HR, begging to find out how she could safely return to work. She was told that she was free to return to her job, but with no assurance that her health needs would be met, so she didn't. Finally, in August 2024, now 3 months pregnant, she received an email stating that she had been fired for abandoning her job. The entire experience left her feeling like nobody had listened to her. It feels like you're another number in a sea of people, Hollis said. It broke my heart. Amazon is the country's second largest private employer and a name brand that millions of Americans interact with every day. It is where we turn for everything from socks to swimming pools. In 2025, it booked $426 billion in net sales in North America. But the company's relentless focus on moving products as fast as possible from its warehouses into American homes has often created brutal working conditions. A 2021 report from the Strategic Organizing Center found that in 2020, Amazon's warehouse workers experienced an injury rate of 6.5 out of every 100 full-time employees, much higher than the rate of 4% in non-Amazon warehouses. In 2023, the company recorded 30% more injuries than the industry average for warehouses. Amazon expects workers to move at unsafe rates and in unsafe conditions, a report issued by Senator Bernie Sanders found. At the same time, the company makes it extremely difficult for employees to take time off for medical needs. A 2020 report by the nonprofit legal organization A Better Balance on attendance policies like the one at Amazon, which penalizes employees when they take unsanctioned time off, found that the companies that deploy them frequently fail to tell workers about their rights and violate laws that entitle them to paid time off for sickness, disability, pregnancy, or childbirth. These problems become even more acute when the warehouse employees are pregnant. In the interviews with The Nation 5 current or former employees who were pregnant while working at Amazon reported that their requests for minor accommodations at work, such as taking more breaks or avoiding heavy lifting, were denied. They were made to endure grueling conditions, forced to go on unpaid leave just when they needed extra income to get ready for a new baby, and retaliated against when they dared to ask for what they needed. These problems all occurred after the Pregnant Workers Fairness Act, which bans these practices, went into effect June of 2023. These issues do not seem to be isolated. In February, the director of Washington Field Office of the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, the agency that enforces the PWFA, determined that there was evidence that Amazon's treatment of pregnant women across its warehouses had violated the law. This is not a gray area, Liz Morris, coordinator of the Center for Work-Life Law at UC Law San Francisco, who is not representing any of the workers interviewed by The Nation. What we are seeing at Amazon are precisely the harms that the law was designed to prevent. In response to requests for comment, an Amazon spokesperson said, "The claims that we don't follow federal and state laws like the Pregnant Workers Fairness Act are simply not true." The spokesperson said that 99.9% of pregnancy accommodation requests had been approved in the past year, and contend that the workers' stories contain inaccuracies and omit important details, while saying that the company couldn't share an individual employee's details. In 2024, Tamisha, who requested that The Nation only use her first name, was working at an Amazon warehouse in Virginia, retrieving products to be packed for orders, which required constantly climbing ladders and lifting heavy objects to maintain a rate of 300 units per hour. Tamisha found out that she was pregnant with twins at the end of May of that year. She sent Amazon a request for accommodations the next week, but the company didn't respond until mid-July. Tamisha tried to keep working, but it was hard on her body, and she kept accumulating penalties when she had to leave her workstation to throw up. "I felt like I was going to pass out on station a couple times," she said. When Amazon finally responded, the company said that she could either keep working with no changes to her job or go on unpaid leave. Tamisha chose the unpaid leave, knowing that she couldn't keep doing the work. The loss of income came just when she had to cover $30 copays for her frequent doctor visits. She fell behind financially. She had just moved out of her parents' house and didn't have a partner to help. "I couldn't win for losing," Tamisha said. Extremely stressed, she lost one of the twins she was carrying. After she eventually returned to work, she developed high blood pressure and preeclampsia, which required her to give birth to the surviving twin at just 29 weeks in an emergency C-section. Her baby ended up in the neonatal intensive care unit for 140 days. After she gave birth, Tamisha was told she had to return to work full-time, even with her baby in the neonatal unit, ICU, for at least 2 weeks before she could go back on unpaid leave to be in the hospital with her infant. Tamisha called HR crying. "I'm not going to choose you over my baby," she told the representative, who switched her to a flexible schedule that amounted to only 30 hours a week, but allowed her to stay with her baby when she needed to. Eventually, her baby left the NICU, but needed a feeding machine, which kept Tamisha tied to the 30-hour flex schedule instead of the 40 hours she had worked previously. Her baby is now a year and a half old, and financially, I'm playing catch-up, Tamisha said. She's moved back with her parents. She feels tied to her Amazon job. It's not easy to get a new one in our current economy. Plus, the $21 hourly wage is better than what many other jobs pay. But it's all taking a mental toll. They didn't hear me. Nobody heard me at Amazon, Tamisha said. Amazon is not a good company. The Pregnant Workers Fairness Act covers workers as soon as they apply for a job and applies to employers with 15 or more employees. It requires employers to meet their pregnant workers' needs for accommodations unless they can prove with evidence that the changes would pose an undue hardship. Employers must respond to accommodation requests without necessary delay, said Catherine Greenberg, Vice President of Litigation at A Better Balance, which is representing some of the workers the nation spoke with. Regulations published by the EEOC make it clear how employees are supposed to follow the PWFA. Employers are forbidden from requesting medical paperwork for straightforward accommodations, such as more breaks, sitting or standing more often, and other needs that are obvious and known. Accompanying accommodations like this will, in almost all instances, not pose an undue hardship for an employer, Greenberg said. For other needs, such as avoiding heavy lifting, employers can ask for medical documentation, but only for the minimum necessary. Employers can't require the documentation to be in a particular form, which means that if a worker submits a doctor's note saying she needs to avoid lifting more than 30 pounds, an employer can't then ask her to fill out a specific form. Amazon said that in most cases the company requires documentation from an appropriate health care provider and may follow up to request additional documentation if it feels the original lacks sufficient detail. The law also requires that employers engage in an interactive process with employees to find a solution that addresses the needs of both sides, similar to what is mandated by the Americans with Disabilities Act. It's incumbent on the company to at least try to find something that works for the worker, said Gillian Thomas, senior counselor at the ACLU's Women's Rights Project, who is not representing the Amazon workers. The lack of a good faith back and forth, said Imani Chatier, the president of A Better Balance, means that Amazon system is set up to violate the law. The PWFA bans employers from forcing workers to go on leave while the two parties are discussing the accommodations, or as an alternative to providing accommodations. But the workers I spoke with reported that Amazon, after they submitted a request, their managers asked them to choose between working without changes or going on unpaid leave. The company sat on the request for weeks or even months, the workers said, during which time they either went without pay or kept performing dangerous tasks. When asked about these practices, the Amazon spokesperson said that employees may be placed on leave if they indicate they are unsafe to work while their accommodation request is being evaluated. And depending on eligibility and state laws, this leave may be paid.